Some more spatial updates in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the Earthbound studio of the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, in toasty Northwest Arkansas, with the rain report for June 16th. Look up in the star-studded heavens most any night, and you'll probably get a glimpse of the International Space Station, home of ERIS, amateur radio on the International Space Station. AMSAT North America, the Radio Amateur Satellite Corporation, is likewise alive and well, as you'll hear in this week's rain report. Here are two excerpts from the AMSAT Forum held at the 2018 Dayton Hamvention in May. The first voice you'll hear is Frank Bauer, KA3HDO, the International Chairman of the ERIS Committee, as well as Vice President of Human Space Flights for AMSAT North America.
For those that don't know, this is You Are Here. We're in two locations right now, a space station in the Columbus module and in the Russian service module. I think most of you know that. That's where our ham stations are located. We got VHF and UHF in the service module, and VHF right now operational in the Columbus module. We have slow scan and ham TV. I want to convey in this chart is how comprehensive our program is right now. It's the most challenging we've ever had. It's fun, but we're doing a lot of things, and I'm going to talk about a lot of these things. The one thing I'm not going to talk a lot about is the space agency collaboration, which is important for AMSAT and ERIS's future. If you know what's going on in human spaceflight, there's all this talk about going to Mars and now to the moon, depending on who you're talking to. But internationally, there's plans to go into Deep Space Gateway, which is between the moon and the Earth in that area, as a way of being able to gateway stuff from there to the moon or to Mars or whatever. We've been working both on the European side and on the U.S. side with our space agencies to make sure they understand that amateur radio has done these kinds of things before in space, has done it all the way out to receiving Voyager signals, receiving Cassini signals. And so that we can do this stuff. And so we put in a request for information that came out of ESA. On the ESA side, our ERIS Europe team, and on the U.S. side, we've had several conversations with NASA on the Deep Space Gateway. The next couple charts are a shout-out to our sponsors, CASIS and SCAN, the NASA Space Communications Navigation Organization, provide the funding that supports our operations. That's $150,000 a year that they're providing to us. And then, of course, the amateur radio leadership from this organization, AMSAT North America and ARL, two tremendous partners for our support. And then the next chart actually shows some of our other major sponsors. Kenwood, over the years, and continues to be a major sponsor. DARA, of course, and QCWA, Joe Lynch, and Yaz. Chet Ladewick, VE3, Charlie Fox Kilo, is our new ERIS delegate, our AMSAT North America delegate for Canada. And we're looking forward to working with him on our endeavors. Our next ERIS International meeting is going to be in the U.S., it'll be in the Washington, D.C. area, College Park, Maryland. We've got a lot of different things going on. We're going to have a two-day education summit. It's a U.S.-based activity. We're going to have some NASA tours in the afternoon of Tuesday. Of course, three-day ERIS International meeting on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And then Saturday, October 20th, we will have our hardware development discussions. We can have dedicated discussions there. So this is an opportunity to meet the international team and learn more about ERIS and actually have fun. I also wanted to talk about the fact that since we talked last, we've established an education committee. We have an operations committee that's been going on since the beginning. We have 22 U.S. team members that are educators or informal education individuals that are supporting this. They're supporting the proposal process for the contacts. They're supporting us in booths all over the United States that we are doing for CASIS and for SCAN. And they're interested in mentoring our educators, basically mentoring the teachers that are going along and helping with lesson plans. Bottom line is we're trying to make our program even more comprehensive in an education perspective. Some of our operational accomplishments include the fact that we touched last year about 170,000 people. Just think about that. Both students as well as the general public. And this is direct touch from the perspective of they were in the rooms when we were doing these things. Indirect means that they're might be in a classroom as compared to in the auditorium when these things are happening. Girl Scouts of America are just three of the many contacts. We did 81 contacts last year, and we're approaching 1,200 contacts since we started in December 2000. ARL sponsored the development of a pre-contact video to get the students and the general audience aware of amateur radio in a more in-depth way and what's going to happen before the contact. So we wanted to make that similar from contact to contact. So where are we with the onboard status? From the service module perspective, we're pretty much where we were last year. The radio, the D710 that's on there is a stock radio, has really no frequencies in it, if you will. So we're just operating it in a kind of a, I'll call it a kludge mode, if you will. It's not the way we want to operate, but it is a powerful unit. And you all know that because you can really hear it beam down. Things that have changed, I know everybody knows we're down with digital right now. And that doesn't mean we don't like digital. It's just died out, so we aren't doing APRS. But I'm going to talk a little bit about the interoperable radio system. We had a little bit of a design changes going on with the interoperable radio system. We thought we were going to launch by October. We're probably going to launch in January, February timeframe at this point. What that meant is we had a little downtime, and we decided to work with NASA and fly one of our flight backup packet modules, and Lou, myself, and a few others, Kenneth Ransom, spend the time to get that certified, flown. Expectation is we're going to have all the paperwork done before July, and it'll fly in early October on either Soyuz or Progress. And if we can get on another earlier flight, they'll put us on it. It's what they told us. We're trying to get that up and operational again as quick as possible. You probably saw a press release from us about the ham TV system. We're having the transmissions have been out for several weeks. We've been doing a lot of troubleshooting with the astronauts. We've got a couple more things going on. We got to go through these beforehand. Unfortunately, when ESA built the ham TV system, they did not build a flight backup. So we have to bring it down, repair it, and bring it back up. That's something that we're working pretty aggressively on. And there's a little bit of a thing we're working relative to making sure that ESA is totally on board on this, because this is really their hardware and we're the custodian of it. So we're working with them on that to expedite this. I wanted to say a little bit more about ham TV, and that's that we will get this back in operation as soon as we can. One of the biggest stumbling blocks we've had is a down converter and the availability of down converters. Art Towsley has been working with our international team and Lou on the development of this little device. Basically, it's a $75 device that you can hook up to a dish antenna, pointed dish antenna, and basically with a piece of software then receive the ham TV system. And so I wanted to make sure you all were aware this is very recent. There's some other units going to be coming out also in Europe, but this is the United States version of it. You can start working on that. Hopefully by then we'll have the ham TV back up and operational. We'd like to get lots of stations up, because then we can chain them together, get lots of signals. So let's talk about the next generation system, and that's the interoperable radio system. Our reality is that we're going to improve our downlink capabilities through a higher power D710GA radio system with a power supply that can support VHF, UHF, voice and packet, and then the slow scan television. We started this program 21 years ago. Bill Tynan, myself, Lou McFadden, and Rosalie White, three of the four, at the first meeting. We're a solid program within NASA, within all of the space agencies that are running International Space Station. And it's the teamwork that's made it happen. And we want to go beyond low Earth orbit. We have this opportunity on Deep Space Gateway.
The voice of Frank Bauer, KA3HDO, the International Chair of the ARIS Committee, as well as Vice President of Human Space Flights for AMSAT North America. Up next, we'll get the lowdown on AMSAT's Fox CubeSats from Jerry Buxton, N0JY, Vice President of Engineering for AMSAT North America. This is the RAIN Report. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The RAIN Report from www.therainreport.com.
The Fox 1 CubeSat had great success with them. We have three of them in orbit right now. Fox 1A, the first one built, is AO85. That was launched October 2015. Fox 1B, AO91 went up in November of last year, and Fox 1D Delta went January of this year. Fox 1 Cliff is pending launch later this year, so is Fox 1E. Fox 1 Cliff will go on a spaceflight launch, an SSOA mission that they have. Fox 1E is Radifexsat 2, and it's got a linear transponder versus the others, and it will fly on the Virgin Orbit, they renamed themselves, sometime this fall. I can't disclose it, and they're really not quite that settled this yet, but it should be before the end of the year. The first four of them had single-channel FM transponders. If you're familiar with them, if you've worked them, AO85 started out a little bit hard of hearing. It was difficult to work at our target of a 5 watts and a narrow antenna, essentially as an easy sat. I have explained that in various places. If you aren't familiar with that and are curious, I do have a YouTube video, The Good and the Bad of AO91, I believe is what I called it, that touches on that based on the results we saw with AO91. Three of the four, yeah, have an AFC built into the receiver. With the UHF uplink, the generally 5 kilohertz steps that you get on an HT, the Doppler on 70 centimeters is plus or minus 9 kilohertz during the pass. The AFC was formulated in order to help. AFC, as you may know, it locks on to your signal. It does lock on to the strongest signal, so you've got to be the top dog in the pile up there, if you will, to actually capture it. But it helped. It was provided as a little assist for the Doppler tuning. We disabled it on Fox 1 Cliff because before we had determined what the cause of Fox 1A's problem was, we weren't sure if the AFC might not have been part of it. So with Fox 1C and D pending an earlier launch at that time, we disabled on Cliff, left it on D so that we could make an observation to determine whether or not that was it. Of course, their launches got postponed, and we figured out what was wrong before they ever went up. But when you work them, Fox 1 Cliff will require a little bit more attention to the Doppler tuning. Both C and D have the L-band downshifter, and what that does is it provides the opportunity for an L-band or 1.2 gigahertz uplink, again on FM. The sensitivity of that is great, as well as the 70 centimeter receiver on B and D right now. The L-band uplink, some HTs have L-band. It provides a great opportunity to signal to get into some microwave work. And essentially what it does is it receives at 1.2 gigahertz, converts it down to the 70 centimeter input frequency and passes it on into the existing receiver there. Of course, we got the telemetry simultaneous with those train, which I can't figure out, haven't worked for the railroad, how that sounds like a train, but the train sound that you hear, the rumble, not all radios catch it, but below the voice. Fox 1E being not originally planned, the Fox 1 was supposed to be 4 CubeSats. We had leftover parts, if you will. I kind of tossed out the challenge, also with some nudging from people like our Vice President of Operations to go with a transponder. So Fox 1E is kind of an experiment in itself to fly a transponder. So it will have a 30 kilohertz transponder. We turned it around with VHF uplink and UHF downlink, and we expect that will provide up to maybe 10 SSB QSOs at a time, depending on how friendly you are with your signal. So that'll give us a little bit of transponder activity in LEO. It will also have a separate telemetry channel. The downlink will be 1200 BPSK on a separate frequency, so it's not embedded below the transponder itself, and you got the whole transponder to yourself for the communications. So overall, as a look back so far, we're 3 for 3. We've lived up to the EasySat claim, despite AO85 being a little bit hard of hearing. It can be worked, you know, with 5 watts and an arrow. It was and continues to be. Of course, when you get a bunch of people vying for it, then that tends to lose out because it does require a little bit more signal. You can work any of 91, 92, and therefore I expect whatever Fox 1 Cliff will be called with a handheld and a quarter wave antenna. We found that in testing an aftermarket quarter wave on the UHF. It was solid signal, in and out. So they're very sensitive. The change, the fix we made to the Fox 1 to allow for what happened to the Fox 1 antenna, Fox 1A just took care of the receiver sensitivity problem. And we also found that on L-band, it is just as sensitive. I had originally advertised 100 watts ERP as a suggestion for L-band before we flew it because we weren't certain. We have found that Paul Stetzer, I believe he has a 1-watt HT that does 1.2 gigahertz, and his Iowa Yagi that he uses, Iowa Arrow, I think, and he gets into that just fine. So I'm thinking pushing about 10 watts ERP out of that. So it works very well. We've seen a lot of new people trying out the satellites. The nice thing about the Foxes and the reason they're designed the way they are as an easy sat is to give new hams an opportunity. If you have your technician license, you probably have an HT. And even with a simple antenna, you can build, you can try it out and see if you like satellites. And if that works good for you, then there are other exciting things to do in the satellite world as well. Cheap test drive. I have been producing some videos and streaming some videos. Some of you may have seen them on YouTube, and then I moved over to Twitch for the live streaming. Because from my perception as the VPE, you know, we say we're going to build a satellite or something, and then things kind of disappear for about 4 years, and we come back with a satellite. So everybody wonders what's going on. Believe me, there's a lot of work going on to get something that's space-worthy that is going to be a high guarantee of success in our terms and last a long time. It takes a lot of work. So some of that, which in the beginning I had a bit of the Fox One engineering model that I had videoed, and now here at the end, it's mostly testing of the flight models. And I stream that from what I call Fox Labs, which is my workshop in Granbury. They can be long videos, but if you want to tune in and find out a little bit about what it's really like, you can speed it up, you can skip through it. A two-hour video is just a kind of a slice of one test that we have to do, so it gives you an idea of what we do. I also produce now and then a maybe 15-minute video to talk about certain things. I did one called RadEffectSat Tour, I believe, describing a bit about the Foxes in general and RadEffectSat as I had the flight model in hand, and good and the bad with AO91 that I mentioned, which talks about some of the trials and tribulations that even though we've built essentially five identical Fox satellites in a sense, every one of them has its own string of problems. They are very complicated, and they are very fitful and will drive you nuts right to the end.
The voice of Jerry Buxton, N0JY, Vice President of Engineering for AMSAT North America, from the AMSAT Forum held at the 2018 Dayton Hamvention in May. To read more about AMSAT, go to amsat.org. That's AMSAT.org. The RAIN Report is copyright 1990-2018 RAIN. All rights are reserved. The RAIN Report updates Saturday mornings on therainreport.com. This hamcast is heard on International Shortwave Saturday evenings in North America on WTWW out of Lebanon, Tennessee on 5.085 MHz. That's 5.085. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, with my feet firmly planted on terra firma, bidding you very 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network, where we're preparing for field day. Keep on hamming!